This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's roundup. Thanks again to all the contributors who submitted their video sections for last week. I thought that was a lot of fun and kind of a cool way to highlight some of the contributors to the site. And of course, and obviously, thank you all for watching and for your very nice comments. I appreciated all of those. Got an absolutely filled week this week. I don't know if that means that next week's episode is going to be super short, because there's a lot of stuff to talk about in this week. I never really put too much thought into that. I kind of always feel like these are as long as they need to be. Sometimes they're very quick, sometimes not, but we'll see how this week goes. I'll stop rambling and let's just jump right into it. First up, Video Games New York has just successfully funded a Kickstarter campaign for replacement plastic shells for Dreamcast VMUs. So these aren't replacement VMUs, they're replacement plastic cases for them that are injection molded and come in a bunch of different colors. The price is about $16 each, and they should ship to customers this fall. And there's a few things to note about this. First, it seems like production samples have already started coming in, which is a really good sign whenever you're pre-ordering any kind of injection mold stuff, because injection molding is way harder than people who have never done it before could really guess. There are so many things about getting it without blemishes and getting the plastic to feel right so it doesn't feel like a thin piece of paper. It actually feels like the original, like it's supposed to. And if production samples are already coming in before the Kickstarter was launched, then my confidence level is much higher, because if those samples arrived and they were horrible, I don't think they would have ever launched the Kickstarter. Apparently, some of those samples are going out to reviewers soon, so people will be able to get hands-on experience with it. And it's a pretty easy review. Do they fit? Does it bulge when you put it on? Does it feel like the original? Are there blemishes? You know, you don't need any kind of special equipment for this. You just basically need to be able to bolt one on and see what it looks like. So I'm pretty sure this is a safe bet. And also, their timetables are very realistic. Saying that, you know, this Kickstarter is going to end at March or early April, and then you're going to have shipping to customers in September is very realistic for injection molding that you've already completed the tool for it. So all, you know, with all Kickstarters, you never know if you're ever going to actually get what you paid for until it arrives at your door. But this is about as safe as you could imagine for something like this. They've already done the hardest steps. Video Games New York is already a store that ships product all over the place. So there's not much to worry about in this one. So if you have a working VMU and you just want to put a nicer looking shell on it, or maybe you want a shell to match one of the controllers you have or something like that, definitely check out the Kickstarter campaign. And I believe since some of their stretch goals are either about to be hit or already hit, more colors should be added as well. So check out their Kickstarter for all the details. Video Game Perfection is now selling a black injection molded replacement case for the OSSC Pro. This is obviously for people who maybe damaged their case, or if you were one of the early adopters that got the very low run of first production in a white, very nice 3D printed case, but maybe you wanted the black one instead, this is for you. The price is about $15 plus shipping, and they, as well as the OSSC Pro, are still both in stock if you're interested in those. So links for everything right here in the description. I do have a kind of a strong opinion on this one, and you're absolutely welcome to disagree with me. This is only an opinion, but if I had gotten, for personal use, not retro RGB use, if I had gotten one of the original run in that very nice white 3D printed case, I would kind of be looking at it as, oh, cool, I got an early adopter Founders Edition. I made that up, not Marcus. If you think that's dumb, blame me, by the way. But I would look at it like that, like, wow, this is kind of special. It's very good quality, but it's different. It, you know, it doesn't, it doesn't look like everybody else's. You know, I get a weird free reward for being an early adopter type of thing. That's kind of how I would look at it from a personal point of view. Now, of course, for retro RGB, I need to use whatever is the mainstream, so that way people could see in my videos what it is that they're going to be getting. So hopefully somebody who gets an OSSC Pro locally might let me borrow one so I could take some B-roll footage of the proper production case that everybody else is getting. But, you know, that's kind of my opinion on it. Now, I have absolutely heard people say things like, hey, all of the renders that we were shown were in black. All of my other equipment is black. This white case stands out. You know, I really want to replace it with one that just matches all of my other equipment. That's totally fair. I've also heard some people a little frustrated that maybe if you were one of those early adopters, you could have done something like get your order number and maybe only pay for shipping or pay a dollar plus shipping for this because you were an early adopter. Shouldn't you be rewarded with the opportunity to buy another case? I don't disagree with any of that. And, you know, so if you don't like the original look of the case, or if you really feel like you should be, you know, you should have gotten the opportunity to get this cheaper, I get it. I understand. And I'm not throwing shade. I just personally would have looked at this as like, hey, isn't that neat? I get something kind of special that there aren't very many of. So you're all welcome to your own opinions. I just kind of wanted to share the different perspectives I had heard bounced around about this. But either way, if you want to buy either the OSSC Pro or the black injection molded case, links for everything are in the post. Next up, Gary from Rock Solid Productions is now selling SNES and SNES Junior replacement trays that allow for Japanese games to be used on North American consoles. The price is about $22 plus shipping, and there's a bunch of different colors to choose from. So I got to step back a moment for anybody that's unaware. North American consoles and Japanese consoles, for at least the SNES in the context of which I'm talking about, the only real difference is the shape of the cartridge itself, allowing it to fit into a Super Nintendo. They're both NTSC. The motherboards are essentially the same thing other than the RF, because, you know, the different channels that it outputs to, and the power jack. But really, they're basically the same motherboard in the same console. The only thing that's stopping you from using Japanese games on North American Super Nintendos is a physical limitation. And you can get around this by using a Game Genie. You could leave your top unbolted and then just remove the top whenever you're using Japanese games. Or you could cut the plastic tabs inside the cartridge tray, which I absolutely hate doing that. I don't know why that caught on so much. It really bugs me when I see game stores doing it and kind of advertising it as a feature. It just, cutting stuff like that where you could never put it back the way it was always bugs me. And every time I say that, there's always a group of very loud people that tell me, it's my console, I'll do what I want with it. That's absolutely fine. You could do whatever you want, but I'm somebody that truly believes that you should just leave these things the way they are, unless you're doing things like replacement shells, replacing yellowed, cracked ones. But if you have a really nice condition Super Nintendo shell, don't be cutting it up. And even if you think it's adding functionality, what if you someday get a Japanese Super Famicom? So now you have both. You never needed to cut it in the first place. So I'm definitely, you know, that's why I started hashtag no cut mod all those years ago. I'm absolutely against that. So enter people like Gary and Greg from LaserBear had done the same thing for the N64. And I believe somebody else had also done something similar for the SNES Mini a couple years ago. But I don't think anybody had done it for the larger Super Nintendos. But basically, you just take the top off and all you need are the lockout bit screwdrivers and a regular screwdriver. I have a links to just random ones, cheap ones I found on eBay if you want, on Amazon. But honestly, this is as easy as it gets. You don't need to hire installation service unless you're getting other work done. So if you wanted somebody to recap your console, do an, you know, RGB bypass and add these, fine, throw it all in together. But if you just wanted to add this, just pick up some screwdrivers. It's no big deal. Unbolt everything, bolt it back in, and now you could fit both styles of cartridges in there. It'll work. It will not work with PAL games. It's not going to magically play 50 hertz PAL games on a 60 hertz NTSC Super Nintendo, but you will get the Japanese games to fit in, and it should just work great. And I believe this would also work with the Retro Gamer Store replacement shells, which is kind of why the different color options are very, very cool as well. So if you're interested, check out the post, and also Gary has two different videos on it, so you could check those out. But I'm always a big fan of not cutting your console unless you absolutely need to, or unless the console is just destroyed anyway, like one of those beat up yellow SNESs where everything's kind of falling apart. Fine, but still consider this instead, especially for around $20. I mean, it's very fair, and you know, it does kind of save your console from cutting. Wizzo's remote app, that thing that I've been talking about nonstop since it came out, is now available for free on both the Apple and Android app stores. So right now you're able to use either of those apps or just a web browser to access your Mister remotely. And this app completely changed the way I use Mister, from things like switching which Mister INI profile you're using to using this to flash NFC cards if you're using Tap2. I mean, the functionality that this adds to your Mister is absolutely insane, and all of it's free. I do strongly recommend considering signing up for Wizzo's Patreon to continue to support this work, but even if you're not in the position, you could still just go into Update All, enable the Wizzo scripts, launch remote, that's it. Then you go into the remote app. All you would need is the IP address, so after you boot your Mister, hit escape and go left, and there you go, you should see the IP there. And you could change the name of it, so you use the remote app to just change, like the one that I've been using, my main test Mister is from Retro Castle, so I just named it Castle. So then whenever I load up the app, I just type in castle.local, wait a few seconds because the app scans to make sure that the Mister is actually on the network before allowing it to connect, and that's it. And then you have full control through your phone, so you don't need to leave a keyboard plugged in anymore. If you have a dedicated arcade setup, you could use that to make any changes so you don't have to log in remotely through a PC or reach underneath and, you know, plug in a PC keyboard or something like that. Honestly, I think I need to do a video just showing people how to install remote, how to use the app, and then how to do things like flash the NFC cards. And it shouldn't be too hard of a video, but this is the type of thing where you hear me talk about it and it probably sounds like, oh, that's neat. But once you start actually using it, it's a complete game changer for your Mister's workflow, both the Tap and the remote app, by the way. So shout out and thank you to Wizzo for giving us all of this stuff completely free. Once again, please consider signing up for the Patreon because it's the only way we could continue development of stuff like this. But I'm absolutely pumped to use it. And thank you again to Wizzo for releasing these on all platforms. It's very cool. Next up, Digital Eclipse has just released LlamaSoft, The Jeff Minter Story, which is essentially a game collection for basically every modern platform out there that includes 42 of Jeff Minter's games, including a remastered version of Grid Runner. So this is kind of awesome because anybody that's ever played Tempest and a lot of the other Jeff Minter games, but for me it was really Tempest 2000 where I was just like, holy crap, what a unique and interesting and addicting game. I think I told the story many times where the first time I really sat and played it with a spinner controller, I was like, oh, that's neat. I'm glad I did that. And I looked at the clock and like 40 minutes had passed. I thought it was like 5. So it's very cool to see these games live on through compilations like this. And Digital Eclipse, for their Atari 50 collection, used some very awesome emulation that was accurate and very low latency, and it was praised by basically everybody. So I'm hearing so far that a lot of the same stuff was used on this, especially for Rich Whitehouse's Atari Jaguar emulator was used on this. So that's a great way of getting Tempest 2000 to be played. So I was just kind of excited to see this. And while I haven't had a chance to test it out yet, it is something that I think I'd like to have some interest in. Of course, the very first thing I thought of when I saw this pop up was, so who's selling the spinner controller for any of these platforms that could play allow you to play Tempest with it? I actually haven't gotten the answer to that yet. Hopefully somebody listening might be able to provide that. But if you want more info on this, there's also a launch trailer. But Sam Moskovich did an interview with Jeff Minter, and I really enjoyed it. I went through and read it all, and it was kind of cool hearing right from him about that stuff. So I linked to everything here. I just put the main Digital Eclipse link rather than link to individual content, because it's really out for everything now. And I believe it's digital only, at least at the moment. So I just left a link to the main page and then, of course, to Sam's interview. But yeah, this was neat. And I'm really hoping to give this a try. And once again, if you know you could get spinner controllers working on it, let me know. Tito from Macho Nacho Productions just did a video about a new Nintendo DS ROM cart called the Easy Flash Parallel. And right off the bat, at least at the moment, it doesn't do anything more than any of the other stuff that you've seen on the market. I think most people are probably familiar with the R4 carts. So the functionality is about the same, but what you're getting for the $25-ish that it costs is a higher build quality and knowing that you're not getting a clone device. And while the R4 carts are already cheap in themselves, the clones are even cheaper and even lower quality. So, you know, a lot of people have used their R4 carts, never had issues. Some people got the time bomb ones and were pretty upset about that. But I think, generally speaking, if you're going to be using a product, spending a little bit more on something that you know is of better quality, it's probably something that's a good practice and something you should really try to do. I mean, it's $25. It's not like the R4 cart is $5 and then the Easy Flash Parallel is $200. I mean, it's $25. So it's still reasonable to say, hey, yes, it's five times as much, but it's $25. The build quality is a little better. And this includes a small FPGA on there that could potentially be used for some additions to homebrew stuff in the future, but that's absolutely not used right now. So basically, if you're looking for a Nintendo DS ROM cart, absolutely check out Tito's video. He goes through all of this stuff, but your choices are get the old school R4 cart for very, very cheap, hope it lasts, and you should be fine, or probably invest a little bit more money into this and have something that should be solid. Obviously, time will tell. This is a new product, and who knows if it's still going to be running 5 or 10 years from now, but the build quality looks solid, and as always, it's just worth checking out Tito's video because those are always fun. So thanks to Tito for covering this, and I mean, this is probably the one I would get if I wanted one for my NDS. Next up, Miss Mad Lemon is now selling a cassette version of her latest album, Step Inside. The price came to just about $20, which included shipping to the New York City area, and that also included a digital copy, so if you hadn't bought the album yet, you could buy this cassette and get the digital version of it along with it for the same price. Now, I am obviously a big fan of Miss Mad Lemon's music. I covered the last three of her albums here, and when Zaman came out, I loved that one so much, I wanted to put it on cassette to hear how the differences would be for some of the virtual instruments. And it was kind of a fascinating experience because some of those virtual instruments definitely changed their sound after being added to magnetic tape media rather than just being played straight through via digital. And I don't know if I would call one better or worse, but it was definitely different in a really interesting experiment. So I'm really curious to see how Step Inside sounds because now, you know, the creator herself got to listen to it and kind of give final approval on this thing. So I'm really interested to see how this comes out. And I'm always kind of a big fan of not just physical media, but listening to it in different ways. And many brand new created albums don't sound that good on cassette or vinyl because they were always meant to be digital. All the plugins had their analog warmth added to it. And in the past couple of years, anybody who's done music creation knows that Heat plugin used to sound like noise. And now it actually is starting to get stuff like to sound more analog. So I don't know. I'm kind of interested to see how this came out, but because this was created using Amigas, Amiga emulation, I have a feeling having it on analog media might be a really good fit for it because that's the way those sounds were kind of always displayed. But anyway, if you want to hear more directly from Miss Mad Lemon, check out an interview we did. There's the video that shows the unboxing of the cassettes and just kind of some more cool stuff. But I will definitely post on social media when my copy of the cassette comes in. I'll do a little listening party and see what I think compared to the full digital copy. The developer Infidelity has just released an SNES to SNES conversion of Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. It's available right now. It's available publicly. Please consider supporting the developer on Patreon, though, because I'd love to see more of this development work continue. And this was the first one that the developer did that I did not stream live. And I'm sorry about that. The reason is that I'm terrible at Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. And I was trying to work with a friend who's very good at it to do a live stream with them. But just life happens and things get busy and you can't always make it. So my apologies. I really loved streaming those other games. At the moment, the other conversions were Metroid, DuckTales, Zelda, Mega Man 1, 2, and 4, and now Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. And this was not as crazy of an overhaul as the others. This was more of a just a conversion, which is still a lot of work, by the way. And just to note, if you want to know why these things are so important and all of the advantages, I linked in the post about a different roundup that I had talked about it. I don't want to waste everybody's time again. But basically, they eliminate slowdown, reduce sprite flicker, and allow for SNES-related enhancements that are not possible on NES. It's the short version. But this one was really done just as a personal challenge to see if you could port the MMC2 mapper to the SNES, and it obviously was a success. One of the things that he had to do to work around it was move the HUD to the bottom of the screen, and on the very top of the screen, the black area over the crowd is where he was able to have F-blank happening to transfer tiles to VRAM. NES and SNES programmers will understand what that is. So this was kind of an experiment to see, could it be done? It could. And now he's looking to move on to the Konami VRC2 mapper to see if that's possible to run on the SNES as well. So this is cool. You know, for all of these that I've played, Metroid especially was just the absolute biggest overhaul. That was mind-blowing how much of a different game it felt like after playing it with the small tweaks, but on the SNES. But that, DuckTales, Zelda, the Mega Man, I don't think I'll ever play the original NES versions anymore. DuckTales wasn't bad on NES. I don't really have any complaints for that one. And the same with Zelda, but the slowdown with those dark nuts and some of those dungeons used to drive me crazy even as a kid. So I don't know. I think for the most part, I'm only going to be using these conversions and playing them on an SNES from now on. But if you're interested, the ROM's available to download. Just check it out for yourself. And let's hope that we get some more of these because they're always interesting. Now it's time for this week's Mr. Updates, care of Lou from Lou's Retro Source. As usual, I'm just going to skim through these, but if you want visual examples and more details, please check out his video. First up, Jimmy Stones just created a test core for Mr. Cade owners. This is a tool that allows Mr. Cade users to test audio, video, and controllers in their arcade cabinets. I absolutely love it. So thank you very much, Jimmy Stones. Any kind of test tools like that are a massive help for people. And even if they're one of those things that you only use once a year, you're really, really happy that you have it available. So thank you for that. Next up, a new version of Tap2 is now available. This release has support for Amiga Vision launching, and it also significantly improves 486 and Neo Geo support. There's also a bunch of implemented fixes to some non-working systems. There's also a new version of the NFC 5141 case, which is modeled after a floppy drive. I saw a video of that on social media, and I thought it was so neat. It looks like you have a floppy drive sitting next to you, but then you just slide in the NFC card, and that's how you load the games. That is really cool, and if you're a vintage PC fan, that's definitely something you're going to want to look into getting. It's just a case around a reader, so it's not anything crazy, but I just love the aesthetics of stuff like that. Next up, Robert Pipe has announced that the N64 core development has ended. It is my very strong opinion that this was a massive success and an insane accomplishment for Robert. Now, the reason that the development ended is because he hit a wall. Due to the limitations of the DE10 itself, the core can't be perfect. It's already running absolutely excellent and could play 95% of the or more of the N64 library, but games like Jet Force Gemini and Conker's Bad Fur Day will have to remain unplayable, at least on the DE10 hardware. So I just want to politely remind everybody that when Robert started this out, it was kind of, I would say at the time, we would have called it common knowledge that N64 probably won't run on the DE10. And then even as he started the project and got some proof of life working, he was always honest with, hey, I got this far, but there's no telling if retail games will ever even run at all. And now we have 95% of the library available running at full speed with options that you can't even do on original hardware in many cases. So I wholeheartedly call this a success. Congrats to Robert. Take a break. And then I can't wait to see what you're working on next. But yeah, this was very unexpected that it was able to come this far, not because of Robert's skill set, nobody doubted that, just because of the limitation of the DE10. So hopefully we'll have more hardware available in the future to us where stuff like this could be finished off and other cores could be added that definitely can't run on the DE10, but I'm looking forward to seeing that. And also there were some more updates to the Sega Saturn core, to both the VDPs and just some general changes as well. So as always, thank you to SRG320 for doing that, because when the Mister Project started, I don't think anybody would have guessed we could see Saturn and N64 on it, let alone all the rest of the awesome stuff. So thank you very much to all the devs. And as always, thank you to Lou for keeping up with this stuff. There's no way I could do it. So thank you very much, Lou. Next up, Mike Chi just posted a very feature-filled, completely free as always, firmware update for the RetroTINK 4K. And to be honest, there were enough features added in this that I could have done a whole follow-up video on it, except some of the stuff I'm about to talk about, I'm already going to be doing a pretty deep dive video on for a different project. So I figured I would just treat this section of the roundup like a mini firmware launch video, if you will. You can get it right from the link here, and also, RetroTINK 4Ks should be back in stock in a month or so, but let's run through all of the updates to this. First up, there's now an enhanced S-Video mode that only works if you're running S-Video through the rear D-Sub port, the VGA input. I want to get that part out of the way because trolls love to say things like, oh, you spent $750 on a scaler and you have to buy another $15 adapter to get the new fee. Whatever, I just beat you to it so I could save your fragile little fingers from trolling in the comments like you always do. Yeah, you do have to use the rear ports. However, Greg from Laser Bear did a very cheap adapter that's very elegant, screws right into the VGA inputs and allows that. If you're using an Extron crosspoint, you're already running YC over that anyway, so you change nothing. So I don't think that's a big deal. But what you do get is actually a big deal. You have now S-Video looking closer to what you would expect from RGB than that you would ever have expected from S-Video. And partially the advantage is that you get the SDP color processing that would normally be associated with just composite or S-Video, but really this is just a mode that is awesome. To cut it as short as possible, you can get S-Video looking almost as good as RGB. Just, you know, add turn on enhanced S-Video in the menu, use the rear port, and you're good to go. Now, the next thing is what I'll be doing a deep dive on. Mike Chi added a bunch of stuff to make this an excellent solution for either playback or capture of VHS or really any magnetic tape media. One of the biggest issues with any magnetic tape media is time-based correction. So the audio and video are recorded on a piece of magnetic tape, and as you play that tape, it always stays in sync because they're always recorded in the same spot on the tape. That's a gross oversimplification, but a very good visualization. But when you're running that tape through digital processing, there's no time codes on there, so whenever there's dropouts or blips, audio might keep running, but video drops out, so you end up with drift that at the end of a long video, the audio and video could be so far off, it's just laughable. There's no way you could actually use that or even correct it in post in any meaningful way. So the biggest VHS-related feature that was added, in my opinion, is essentially built-in time-based correction. Now, you're still going to get those little blips and dropouts now and then, and it's not going to be as robust as a dedicated, one of those rack-mounted, studio-grade time-based correctors that were probably sold for multi-$1,000s back in the early 2000s. You're still going to get a few more blips, but it's going to feel like a CRT and that the image doesn't just drop out. You know, your screen's not going to go crazy. You're not going to get pops. If you're recording, it's going to stay in sync. So that's a pretty big deal. I put together a VHS capture profile for this because when you load this up and you start using it and you get all your settings ready, when you're watching stuff like VHS and Laserdisc, go crazy with the profiles. Add your CRT simulate, add your CRT mask, throw BFI in there to see if that adds some kind of smoother motion for you. Anything that you need to do just for watching tapes, go for it. But when you're recording, you really want a clean image because any kind of compression isn't going to play well with scan lines or anything like that. So I had a custom profile made that I posted here if you're doing VHS capture. I also listed the very basic settings that I added or changed to it. And I listed these here because if Mike adds more features or changes things, that profile I made is going to be useless. But overall, I think that's absolutely awesome. And one of the other things that was added is a 3D comb filter. Now, this is one of the examples that is so far better demonstrated in video, not still captures. So what I'm showing here in the post isn't going to be the best representation. But basically, a comb filter helps with things like dot crawl and rainbow effects, which is what I have demonstrated here. And it could make game content like NES or TurboGrafx-16 over composite look far better. However, I'm personally way more excited about this for older transfer like VHS and Laserdisc. VHS is such a noisy and lossy platform that you probably wouldn't notice it as much as Laserdisc, but you'll still notice things like sharpness and dot crawl and all those weird issues that you'll see without a comb filter. And I did a comparison of a 2D comb filter, the RetroTINK 4K's 3D comb filter, and one that's built into an Osprey capture card that I'm testing at the moment. And I think you would call this a 2.5D plus comb filter, which is a stupid way of saying it's much better than a 2D comb filter, but not quite as good as some of the higher end professional grade equipment out there. But I still strongly think this is more than good enough for 99% of tape transfer and definitely just watching older content on a flat panel. So that's a pretty big deal. I mean, that means that essentially for $750, which is a lot of money, you have the ability to transfer tapes to digital. And you don't need a time-based corrector, which often sell for $900 to $1,500. So the entire TINK 4K, which so many people call expensive, is all you always need to put this stuff into context of what it is that you're doing. I bet you there are going to be a ton of people who own shops that do tape transfer that go, holy crap, you know, my time-based corrector barely works anymore. Why don't I just buy this that has it all built in? I can give people 1080p or 4K versions of their tapes. So yeah, I'm definitely going to be doing a very deep dive on all of that stuff soon, as well as some individual videos broken out just to make the workflow easier. And the next up, the next feature is XBR smoothing, but I got to start out by saying this isn't an anti-aliasing filter. This isn't like a digital 4K M cable or something like that. You have to keep realistic expectations with it, but it is very good. So there's two settings. XBR 1 looks for 45 degree angles, and XBR 2 looks for both 30 and 60 degree angles and kind of smooths them together as they're being scaled. Kelge provided an example of a face that I thought was a really good way to demonstrate this. And it's one of those things where if you look up close, it'd be pretty easy to kind of just say, oh, that just looks soft. But if you're standing from a normal viewing distance and you're looking at this, you could see the pixelization around the eyes and the hair of the face, around the chin. When you go to the XBR smoothing on, you get a feeling that you're just looking at a face. You don't get that pixelation around the sides. So that I thought that was pretty cool. Also, Wobbling Pixels sent me a picture of Super Mario 64 with first just standard optimal sampling and nearest neighbor, and then moving on to XBR smoothing, both kinds of it. And honestly, I thought this was really, really cool as well. Depending on the console, smoothing one, smoothing two, you're really going to have to check it out for yourself and see. But this is one of these things where just try it. It's a new feature. It's free. Put in your game. And if you turn this feature on and you're like, I don't like it, that's fine. You don't take anything away from it, but you might. And I really think that this is the type of thing that smoothing out 3D graphics would be a step in the right direction. Or depending on your content, maybe this is all you would ever need. And I've heard some people say it would be better on 720p to 4K than it would for 240p to 4K. I don't know, that Mario 64 shot looks pretty convincing. So I think this is just one of those give it a try and see what you think type of things. There's also a bunch of other features added that, while are all awesome, I didn't think required as deep a dive as I just did. One of them is minimizing glitching during horizontal resolution changes. And Mike demonstrated that on social media as well. I linked to that right in the post. So that's kind of a cool thing if you're playing games like Chrono Cross or Dino Crisis, where every time you open up the menu, you switch resolutions. That'll be a little bit smoother for that. So overall, it's just awesome. You know, I keep praising this thing because it keeps performing. And I'm shocked that we're already just a few months later getting some pretty massive updates to this. So it's a thanks to Mike for always giving us free updates to the products. There's no software lock. There's no preventing of moving around firmwares. And that was a huge deal on the RetroTINK 5X, because there was some stuff that was included in the 1.0 firmware that almost nobody used, but the people who did really, really appreciated it, that aren't available in the 3.0 firmware, and you, just because of the size of the FPGA, so you just load the old firmware. There's no locking it out, so you're stuck with whatever the newest one is. You just load whatever one you want. So, you know, just can't say enough good things about this, and really happy to see Magnetic Tape Media getting some support, because anybody that has old movies, this might be the best way for you to transfer it. I'll go into that in my deep dive video. There are other methods that are going to be equal and maybe better than, depending on your situation, but there's using the Tink 4K or 5X is definitely not the wrong way to do it. I could promise you that. Next up, Scrap Computing just released more info on their project called the Throttle Blaster, which is a Raspberry Pi Pico way of tapping into your old school computer's CPU and throttling it down to different speeds. So I got to step back for a moment and explain why you would ever want to do this. Old people like me already are probably nodding their heads understanding it. However, with old computers, many of them came with a turbo button, which actually didn't speed the computer up. The turbo button was always on, and then when you turned it off, it would slow the computer down to be compatible with even older software. So what this is trying to accomplish is you would solder this to the pins on the bottom of the motherboard that correspond with the correct CPU pins for throttling, which I guess might seem a little bit intimidating, except the pins of CPUs back then were much larger, so most of us could probably handle doing that. And then it uses the Raspberry Pi Pico to step down in very precise increments. So you don't just get a full speed, half speed button. You could use a knob to dial in exactly the speeds that you're looking for. So if you have a retro PC from the mid-90s, but you're trying to play late 80s games on it, this could actually be the perfect way to dial in the exact speed that you're looking for. Now, of course, you could use software emulation to do all of this stuff for free. Lou from Lou's Retro Source just did a video about the project that allows you to virtually build your own PC inside an emulation box, so you could have older versus newer stuff built in there. But this is for people who really want to use original hardware, who want to add functionality like this. I could absolutely imagine building a badass 90s PC rig, but getting frustrated when I couldn't play 80s games on it. So something like this could be a good solution. So if you want more information and details on this, please check out Vanessa's post as well as the videos themselves. And yeah, this just looks like a fun retro PC project. Next up, Koala Koa just did a basic overview of the three scalers that were released over the past 6 months. Koala kind of approached this from somebody who had bought all three, because he did, I think he actually owns like all the scalers, and went through from the perspective of somebody who's getting to know all three and what to expect, and just some first impression style opinions of it. I had nothing to do with this other than I did help verify the lag test results, because it's retro RGB. You think I'm going to let anything be posted on this website that has lag test results without me making sure it's not BS? So that was the only thing that I had to do with any of this. This was all in Koala's words, his own post. And after reading it, I just said, hey, this is neat. Do you want an account for retro RGB? I would love to help feature this for you. So that's it. I will just say that it's also kind of nice to have somebody else's words out there, because it is very hard to talk about one of these scalers without getting attacked from every angle. So I'm going to go through and echo what Koala said. I'm going to add some of my own thoughts to this. I strongly recommend reading this post, even if you sit through what I'm sure is about to be a very long section, just because it does add some really great perspective, and there's a lot of double checking involved you'll see. Just to start out, though, I got to talk about the lag test stuff, and there's a few things that I want to make very clear. First, Koala tested the same exact way I would. You put a time sleuth directly into your TV. In a perfect world, it would have been a super low latency PC monitor, but as long as you double check your results, it's going to be the same. And then run the time sleuth through these scalers, then the scaler into the TV, and just subtract the TV's lag from the final number, and that's about the lag that you get. Koala's results were spot on to what I had gotten and what I'd seen other people post as well. And essentially, in their lowest latency modes, all three scalers should be considered zero latency scalers. The OSSC Pro and pure line multiplication mode is zero. The Morph and the Tink 4K, I think, can rotate between zero and 2.5 or 3, depending. But honestly, that's zero. And I'm talking about 2.5 or 3 milliseconds, not frames. There are 16.5-ish milliseconds for every NTSC frame. honestly, I've done over 10 years of testing on this. The only people who disagree are people who either think frames or swapping frames and milliseconds in their head, or are people who just wanted an excuse as to why they lost their Smash tournament. 2 milliseconds is zero in the terms of a human with a controller playing a game on a screen. So all three should be considered zero latency controllers. And I wholeheartedly stand behind Koala's decision to test them in their lowest latency modes, because anybody who's going to buy these things who cares about latency are going to look up which mode to switch to and switch it into that. But on the flip side, I wholeheartedly stand by the manufacturer's decision to ship it in their highest compatibility modes. I actually don't remember which mode the OSSC ships in, the OSSC Pro, sorry Marcus, but the Tink 4K and the Morph both ship in their buffered modes, which is the right move. And this is not an opinion. Think about this. You have somebody who's a big fan of this stuff that just dropped money on one of these scalers that plugs their Super Nintendo into and plugs it into their 2016 OLED like I have and doesn't work. How are they supposed to know that the odd timings of the Super Nintendo are the issue, and that combined with the panel is the problem, and you need at least a little bit of buffering? That's not up to the consumer. That's up to the manufacturer to take care of, and it is definitely the right move that they ship them in the buffered modes as default. So both sides of this, I think, are perfect. Koala should have tested the lowest latency modes. A deep dive videos like mine could go into all three modes. That's fine. And then the manufacturers definitely did the right thing by shipping it that way. So wanted to just clarify all of that. And all of the results were also tested and verified by splitting the signal into a CRT and using the 240p test suite. So lag on all of these scalers, not a problem at all, as long as you just use a low latency display, put it in game mode, and put these in their low latency modes. Koala also had an honorable mention of the FrameMeister. And while Koala said it's time to retire these, I slightly disagree. I think if you're a streamer who games on a CRT but streams through your FrameMeister, don't get rid of it. There's no reason to buy anything else. Fire up a Firebrand X profile if you haven't already. It is a perfect device for streaming. If you've already had it integrated into your flat panel setup and you don't feel like you need any of the extra features and the little bit of latency doesn't bother you, there's no reason to spend more money. Leave well enough alone. Enjoy your setup. Everything should be fine. I just would not recommend anybody buy the FrameMeister right now, unless you find one super cheap on eBay and you're using it for streaming, just like I discussed. But I wouldn't go out and hunt one of these down to game at the moment. And, I think that this thing was a game changer, and we probably wouldn't have gotten all the other scalers without this one out there first, kind of paving the way for us. But yeah, Koala's right in that it's kind of time to retire talking about the FrameMeister. But I'm glad he mentioned it, because anytime you talk about scalers, somebody always going to mention, well, what about the FrameMeister? Next up, the OSSC Pro, Koala referred to as the underdog, and I understand why. This project was almost completely canceled. The part shortage almost destroyed it, and I was really worried that Marcus was going to have to walk away from it, but when the chips came back in stock, Marcus finished the product and got it out for sale, and I'm happy to hear that, and I completely agree with Koala's assessment of this unit is a killer. I am extremely surprised and happy with the scaler at a reasonable $330. It is a bargain for the options that you get. I think Koala absolutely nailed it. There's a ton of options, a ton of different things you could do. I haven't even gotten into the downscaling uses of it yet. I should do a video on that at some point in the future. So honestly, the OSSC Pro, it might have been delayed. And yes, it would have made a much bigger splash in the retro gaming scene if it was released when it should have been. But that's not Marcus's fault. It's the part shortage. Can't blame anybody. But it's still an absolutely viable option. Next up, the RetroTINK 4K. I talk about this all the time, so I'm just going to skip through it. Koala agrees that while the price is what he called a wallet-burning $750, you get what you pay for. So I completely agree. I think the biggest problem with the RetroTINK 4K is it's not $99. But my biggest problem with first class is I can't afford it. So, you know, it's the same thing. I made that same analogy in my video. It is currently the king of scalers because it does everything that all the other ones do, at least at the moment. So I think that if budget's not an issue, this is definitely the one to get. But that does not take away from all of the other scalers out there, including the RetroTINK 5X, the TINK 2X, and the original OSSE Pro as well. Next up is the Morph. And it was interesting to see everybody's overview of this, because there were no launch videos made for it. There was really no footage at all of this thing posted. There were some screenshots and that one video of it just powering on just as a proof of life before the pre-orders went on. So one of the things that Koala mentioned is that the menu wasn't very intuitive with, you know, lag settings in a menu, in a submenu. I have to respectfully disagree here. I actually think that the problem is that it wasn't familiar. I don't think that the menu would be looked at as not intuitive if people were seeing it. And the perfect example is that TINK 4K has been shown publicly as the menu was evolving and as Mike was taking feedback from people. And then there were a ton of launch videos to go with it. And people are always seeing footage and seeing it out in the wild. And I think that's why most people get used to it so quickly. I did have a bunch of people message me who got their TINK 4K and say, hey, I can't really figure this thing out. You know, I don't really get it. I'm like, hey, just go watch that video I did again. And then watch some other people's videos, play around with the settings. And everybody that said that to me messaged me within a day. And they're like, oh, no, it's totally fine. I get it now. It all clicked. And I think that is the issue. Not that the Morph isn't intuitive, it's just no one's seen it, so no one was familiar with how things are done inside of it. So I kind of wanted to clarify that. Also, there were a few things Koala pointed out that I kind of have to defend Pixel FX on, as that was their intent. But the case, a lot of people described it as brittle and thin, even though it's injection molded. And if Pixel FX perspective on this was, hey, we're looking to make the cheapest but highest performing scaler we possibly can, this is where I personally would cut corners. It's not a retro game restore shell. You don't need a very thick, beautiful piece of plastic that you're displaying your classic console. You just need a case and you need it to be easily modular so that you could put in those analog bridges when those are eventually released. So as long as their intent was, hey, I want to cut costs to save you money, I will completely and totally defend the, I guess, lower quality injection mold. It's not unfair to call it that. But I do think this is a great example of for the retro game restore cases, which I know has nothing to do with scalers, but you get what you pay for. You know, in order to not get those swirls and blemishes on it, in order to get that thicker finish, you need a very high quality tool. And then you need to spend a lot more money on each. The tool is really where the higher cost comes. The tool, polishing it up, getting it ready. Injection molding is hard. I already went over that in this video. So as long as the perspective is correct, then I'll defend them definitely. Same with the remote to a point. The remote seemed pretty terrible. A lot of people had kind of echoed that. Koala's actually broke on him while trying to use it. I think he posted the video of that, which was kind of funny because it wasn't reading the clicks at all. He had to click like 10 times in order for it to get picked up. And then the battery door just broke off while using it. So that's one of those things that, you know, maybe his was defective. And that's very plausible. Not everything can be perfect on the first try. But while I definitely respect the let me try to cut costs and get a cheaper remote, maybe you should have gotten a little bit better quality remote with that one. But, if for other people that have received their Morph, what did you think about the remote? Was it that bad, or did Koala just get a bum one? The only other thing that Koala mentioned, which I don't have the ability to test, is it got very hot. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything either way. Just because something's running hot doesn't mean it's running out of spec. And that is the most important thing to worry about when you're talking about this stuff. I used to work for a company that designed embedded motherboards for use in medical grade equipment, and their temperature tolerances were far different than consumer products because some of those needed to be sealed and fanless. So you could run them at 70 C all day long and they'll last just as long as a consumer product running at 40 or 50 C. So I don't know if it means anything that it was hot to the touch. Maybe it doesn't. I don't really know. But that's definitely worth looking into because both the TINK 4K and the OSSC Pro have fan options. And in fact, the Pro already has everything cut out and a header right on the board. It's like a 2-minute installation, basically. So I'm not sure if there's any fan options available for the Morph, but I'd be interested to see that. Also, overall, it seemed to perform okay. There were some kind of hiccups in it, but it does kind of feel like a very early firmware. I think a couple of people had described the Morph as feeling rushed to market, which I think is both a good way to visualize it, but it's also not fair, because the original Morph announcement was right after the Tink 5X was released, and they had done that product launch as if it was right around the corner coming that summer. So this is a product that's been deep in development for years now. So I would have hoped that it would have launched a little bit more tight than it did, but I truly think it's got a ton of potential. Also, Koala went into trying different things like running the OSSC, the RetroTINK 5X, and the FrameMeister through the Morph. The FrameMeister didn't work so well, but I don't blame Mecumsoft or PixelFX for that. I think that's just a product that you probably wouldn't want to use as an analog bridge anyway, because it would add a little bit of latency on top of it. So if you have a FrameMeister and you're going to a Morph, sell it. Sell it to some streamer who really just wants a better way to stream their games online, and go pick up like a 2X Pro right now if you want, today, if you need an analog bridge, or you can wait for theirs too, of course, but if you needed it today, that's probably the better way to go. OSSC definitely works, and the Tink 5X also work. So those are both interesting options. I would definitely consider the OSSC, not so much the Tink 5X though. I just think that by itself already is great. All you would really be using is the line doubling from 1080p to 4K, which you could use a 4K Gamer Pro for that too, for much cheaper. I don't know. That's not an insult to the Tink or to the Morph. I'm just trying to add some perspective as when you might want to plug one thing into the other. That is something all of us nerds are guilty of, wondering what happens if you link all this stuff together, but I would kind of keep it separate. Overall though, it seems like the Morph in general seems like it's got a ton of potential. So, final thoughts, it really just depends on you. Koala kind of says the same thing, that, he doesn't really have a suggestion to somebody because it depends on your setup as well. He bought all of them and thought there's a use for each and every one. He said, where does he think the Morph fits in this? He believes it has a comfy spot in between the OSSC Pro and the RetroTINK 4K. Once the analog bridge comes out, that's tested, lag test results, etc. I think that's a pretty fair assessment. And it's also a compliment, right? These are solid products from people who have been out for years. The OSSC products and the TINK products are absolute industry leaders in this thing. So to be able to sit between the two top versions of it is nothing other than a compliment. And if it's taken as anything other than a compliment, that's some self-esteem issues. That is certainly not nerd talk right there. So I do think at the moment, if your focus is something like SCART, it is analog basically, especially SCART, component video, and VGA, the OSSC Pro might actually be the go-to if you don't have the budget for the TINK 4K. I think it could do a lot more, obviously in terms of analog, but with all the features that were focused on that, and Marcus's many years of knowledge being put into line multiplication and stuff like this. But I do think at some point after a couple of firmwares are released, I think that is going to be the hierarchy of where things sit and the most feature filled. And once again, I do think that's a compliment. And I think all three have so much potential to go even farther than they already are. But I also think that the original OSSC, the Tink 5X, and the original Tink 2X Pro are awesome solutions for people as well. There's really no wrong answer with any of those. It just would be what's more right for your current and future setup. I think that's really the thing to take into account. So, you're all welcome to have your thoughts on this. It's very hard to talk about the Morph because whenever I say anything, I get attacked for it. It's very strange. Even when I say compliments that are genuinely meant as compliments, the comment section and the social media starts to get filled with trolling, to the point where I'm almost wondering if it's not even Morph fans, if it's just people who like starting trouble on the internet that have nothing to do with it. I don't know. But it's just hard to talk about it because I don't talk about it. I get trolled for not talking about it. I do talk about it. I'm a biased Tink shill who would never like it, which is BS. I'm a nerd. I love the nerdy products. I want all of this stuff to do well, and I think there's a place for all of them. But I'm also really happy that Koala just took this off of my shoulders and did his own post on it, so I don't have to worry as much about all of that stuff. So, I think anybody who's interested in like an arm's length view of all three of these should definitely go back and read through, even though I kind of just paraphrased it and added my own thoughts. I think reading Koala's thoughts on this is definitely something that you're going to want to take into account before spending your money. And if you've already bought any one of these, you probably already have an awesome product and made the right decision. I just think that as far as path to the future goes, the Tink 4K is already even more feature-filled than what it launched with, and there's more coming. Tink 5X, still some, that's not done yet. There's still some features coming to that, which I'll be talking about soon. I mean, Marcus, the OSSC has had so many firmware updates and continues to, so we could only assume it's going to be the same with the OSSC Pro. And all OSSC and Tink firmwares have been completely free over the years. So I just hope that PixelFX follows suit, continues to add firmware updates, doesn't charge people for new features. And they have not said that they did, that they would. I'm just saying, I hope they follow suit with everybody else in the industry and continue to update it and have it be a product that that's very clear why people would buy it, I guess is the best way to put it. So let me know your thoughts. And, you know, as always, level-headed opinions will always be respected, even if I completely disagree, and morons will be treated as such. Well, that's it for this week. As always, thanks so much to everybody who watches, listens, plays nicely in the comments, and especially thank you to anybody who supports in absolutely any way, because as I went into detail with last week, it really is you who is keeping all of this stuff alive. And I'm so happy to continue to promote all the amazing people in retro gaming and all the amazing products, and I want to continue to do so. So thank you for allowing me to do it, and I will see you next week. This week's roundup is brought to you by Neo Paradigm Entertainment, connecting Southeast Asian influencers with opportunities in the West.